500 nits when you need at least 2,000 nits. And that's the problem with all that intuition.
So I think you're saying, Wes, that if the if I've got a large picture window on my living room and the sun is shining in that window and I want to watch television, I think you're saying OLED might not be bright enough to keep me happy. Is that true?
That is correct. The only thing is that the bigger the picture, the better. Because then the amount of light per inch, square inch, is increasing comparing to the area that's supposed to be light up. That means when you're sitting a few feet in front of the TV, it might be enough. But when you have 52 inches or even smaller, then the most of the customer is complaining, but also the professionals that working with films and editing of films is that it is not bright enough. That's why professional monitors, when they need to really see the color and recognize the proper color for whatever the production they do, especially for Netflix, is that they have to use at least 1500 nits. And I have Shotgun Inferno that by Atom, A Atom, right? That's how the company is called. That's actually what is right now, and it's selling like crazy. It's extremely expensive because it has 1500 nits or 2000 nits. But nothing can beat the quality of the picture of OLED. Intuition.
I'd argue with that a little bit. That little stuff. The name of the game is colorimetry, not brightness. They're always it. Quite nice and bright, but we don't consider them professional because the color temperatures are a little bit different.
So, Eric, are you saying there are some OLED type displays that are almost bright enough to keep a consumer happy?
For the professional who's doing color correction, they're pretty unhappy with those types of screens, but they're available.
Yeah, actually, Eric was right. The color, the temperature. So if you have a 30, I remember I spoke to him a few years ago, and he was beating me like crazy because he knew what I didn't know. 3200 is never to be used, and it's not even, it's too cold. The problem with OLED is that it's cold, Eric.
The thing about these guys is they buy everything that they review at retail. W2BZ.
So I think you guys are saying that the OLEDs tend to be a cold screen. In other words, a lot more blues than reds. Is that what we're saying?
Eric.
Generalized because, you know, it depends on which model number, what year it was made, the last 3 years, the last year. There are too many variables, but as I said, every question you ever had about a TV, a pair of headphones, or a turntable would be answered in a very interesting way, especially for technical guys. And I think there are a few technical guys listening tonight.
At rtng.com is what I think you're saying. Go there, and we're going to find out everything we're afraid to ask. Is that true?
RTINGS, a contraction of ratings. And it's not just the volume of units that they have reviewed and compared. It's the scientific approach to it, which blows my mind.
And were there any further questions on the subject before we leave? Give me a call, letters right now, and name K2LIW.
I would like Eric to give some information about the color. So 3200 is considered to be cold, and that's close to OLED. Now, 700, 5300, and more up, that's the warm color. And I wonder if there is a chance right now in the TVs, because that I don't know. I don't have a TV at home. To regulate the temperature. If Eric can respond to that.
Right, let me get into the color temperature a little bit. Actually, color temperature has moved from the old days of TV, and typically in TV. When we use tungsten light, we use 4,200 degree light, or 3,600 degree light. As we've started to get towards more solid state sensors, we moved to 4,000 degrees and 5,000 degrees. The 3,200 degree stuff is kind of red, so we balanced it out. You put your chip set up, and you made your chip set look black and white based upon the light that was reflecting off of it. Today, we're pretty much in the 5,000 to 5,200 degree range because we use LED light. When we go for daylight, like in film, we really want 6,400 degrees, which is very blue. So as you go to the higher color temperatures, you go to a higher efficiency in terms of light output. So 5,200 is pretty much the standard these days, which is sort of a bit bluish yellow, actually, if you break it down into the individual bits of color. And the standard is pretty tough to meet, especially with LED. So there you go. K2IWK, 2J.
Good stuff. Hey, if you have any further questions or comments, give me a call that is a name right now. Yeah, I'm a real dinosaur. It was only a short period of time ago, only a few years ago, I got rid of my cathode ray tube set. So I was in the dark ages there for a while. Time to go over to the technical talk by Roy, Dr. Roy, AC2GS. You've got it, sir. Take over. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, it'll be interesting to hear how I sound with a mariachi band behind me. This is the Science Talk, and as always, I ask people that if they have any topics or questions or comments or statements or refutations, feel free to email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And for links for any of the material that I'm mentioning, you can just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll get the links. I have a few of them already up with some pretty pictures, and I'll add some more when I'm finished with this little science talk. If you want to join me and a few other people in the chat room, you can type in chat.ac2gs.com, and that brings you to the chat room. So let me drop for a moment, and I'll get on with the news. Okay, very good. I always like to point out interesting images in science. And tonight I have posted on roy.ac2gs the latest color-enhanced shot that was captured by the Juno spacecraft in February and processed by a guy, Kevin Gill. He's a NASA software engineer who renders rather breathtaking images like the one that I posted on the website out of raw data in his free time. You know, he doesn't even get paid for it. Anyway, Juno snapped this image while orbiting just 8,000 miles from Jupiter's cloud top, according to a NASA press release. This was the spacecraft's 18th close flyby since it dropped into the Jovian orbit around mid-2016. The NASA scientists named Juno after the goddess of the same name in mythology. Juno was one of the oldest and most important Roman deities and was the wife of Jupiter himself. Juno sees through Jupiter's using scientific instruments that sense ultraviolet and infrared light, magnetic energy, and even more. The mission goal is to better understand Jupiter's origins and planetary makeup, but the craft JunoCam that captured this stunning cloud photo, this one doesn't really hurt either. In 2021, Juno will put a Cassini and purposely crash into Jupiter to put an end to its mission. But thankfully, there'll be no shortage of cloud photos to enjoy until then. Let me drop for any comments or questions. This is AC2GS. Okie dokie. Next photo is something that might interest some people. Those of you following NASA's New Horizons know that the interplanetary space probe made the farthest ever flyby in human history on New Year's Day, when it circled the Ultima Thule, an object in the Kuiper Belt that we've discussed before here. Now, a discovery from New Horizons' 2015 trip around Pluto and its satellite Charon sheds even more light on the Kuiper Belt, a donut-shaped region of icy bodies beyond Pluto. Analyzing the photos from the probe flyby of Pluto and Charon, scientists have discovered a surprising lack of small objects in the belt. The photographs reveal a few small craters on Charon. By default, that indicates a lack of small impactors. Based on analyzing these craters, the researchers believe most objects in the Kuiper Belt are larger than 300 feet to 1 mile in diameter, which qualifies as small in this case, apparently. For a second. As New Horizons back images of the Kuiper Belt, object 2014 MU69, this discovery by Southwest Research Institute led scientists provide even more information about the belt composition. For starters, it indicates that the objects in the Kuiper Belt are different than those in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. They also give scientists new insight into how the solar system might have originated, though no concrete conclusions have been drawn yet. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Again, this is AC2GX.
Please, AC2GX up.
Yes, Rich. WB2GXM, Rich. I believe you have a...
boundary of the Kuiper Belt is, or are we still searching for the outer boundary of the Kuiper Belt as currently? WB2GXM.
We are still playing games and trying to come up with it. There's a lot of space in space, and no one has definitively decided where it ends.
Very good. Actually, in addition to my question, it appears that ERA KE2EJ is the only signal without the mariachi band. I do not know why. WB2GXM.
I can guess. He's coming in through Echo Link, which is not quite the same route as the ones all of us seem to be traveling in. So my guess is it's not being imprinted in, say, the transmission background. It's being imprinted on the received background through the RF. But that's just conjecture.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I know NASA wants to find a new target for New Horizons before it leaves the Kuiper Belt, and they are guessing. You know, they've got about 3 years of travel. You know, roughly another billion miles or so, and they know that the Kuiper Belt's going to thin out, and once they get past a certain point, you know, their opportunity might be lost. So in that article, they say that they found another object, another target to go to. I haven't found anything yet on that. I mean, that was the plan right after they passed MU69.
As far as I know, so far they haven't come up with any good ideas yet.
Okay. I know Hubble has been looking. And that's how they found this one originally. Okay, very good.
Okay, so I gave you two still images, which I think are very nice. So please, go to roy.ac2gs.com and take a look at them, because they're rather beautiful pictures. My third selection for the night is actually a video, although I can't really post videos on that site. I can only give you a link to where the videos are. Anyway... the new video was released by our good friends, the Japan Aerospace Exploratory Agency, and shows that spacecraft that we keep talking about, the Hayabusa 2, briefly touched down on the surface of the asteroid Ryugu. capturing the climactic moments when the spacecraft fired a bullet into the asteroid's surface. JAXA, Hayabusa 2 probe, bounced off the Ryugu asteroid on February 21st, 2019, in a rapid maneuver in which it discharged its sample collection instruments. Assuming all went well, Hayabusa 2 scooped up bits of asteroidal debris into its sample horn, which the probe will return, hopefully, to Earth for analysis in late 2020. By all appearances, the operation was a success, but we won't know for sure until Hayabusa 2 returns home and its sample chamber is opened and examined. The new video released just this week by JAXA is further proof that the operation went according to plan. During the descent, the probe's small monitoring camera, the CAN, offered a perfect view of the approach, showing Hayabusa 2 moving towards the asteroid. The spacecraft can be seen briefly touching down on the asteroid and then rising up again. Its distinctive shrinking shadow clearly visible on the surface. A cloud of spinning, shimmering debris followed the probe during its descent, a rather strong indication that the procedure worked as planned. Let me drop for a second. So far, so good, but Hayabusa 2 still has work to do. Starting in April, the spacecraft will begin a sequence of operations that will see it extract subsurface material from Ryugu. The probe will create a crater by dropping another small explosive device onto the asteroid, followed by a touchdown to scoop up the debris. So, if they keep on doing things, then it keeps on working. That's very nice to see. Anyway, this is AC2GS. Let me drop for any questions or comments about the good old Hayabusa 2. Okay, dokie, we finished with the slideshow. On to the rest of the entertainment. Does anyone know where they'll be on April 6, 2019? Well, if you heavily rely on GPS, you may not be able to determine where you are or when that date. You may not be able to determine where you are on that date. That's because the GPS navigation technology was originally built with a short-sighted timekeeping system that will reset next month and has the potential to cause some chaos. When Y2K bug threatened to throw the global computer systems out of whack at the turn of the millennium, it set a big panic, and everyone waited for our newly connected world to crumble at the stroke of midnight. When all was said and done, the hype was rather overblown, and the errors that did occur had relatively minor impact. That's probably why a similar flaw in the older GPS system has flown under the radar. We simply refuse to get fooled again, eh? GPS was originally designed to timestamp signals using a system that counts weeks using a 10-digit field that tops out at 1,024 weeks. That's approximately 19.7 years. It expresses the time of the signal sent by the satellite in weeks and seconds in into the week. For a few reasons, the GPS receiver on board has to take the signal and calculate the current date as part of the processes it uses to determine location. Once that 10-digit field in legacy GPS systems fills up, it resets to zero, and that could cause a problem. Let me drop for a second. The U.S. Naval Observatory released a short fact on the issue in 2017 and warned that the GPS receiver's month-year conversion could fail and that incorrect time tags could corrupt some naval data at the systems level. A recent memo from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security explained that a nanosecond error in GPS time can equate to 1 foot of position ranging error. Of course, an error of 19.7 years has the potential to make the navigation rather useless. Is this a very serious problem? Well, probably not, since we've been through this actually before. On August 21st, 1999, the GPS counters reset also, with very little disruption in the daily life. But GPS wasn't as ubiquitous back then as it is today. Still, here in the second epoch of GPS, we've been anticipating the rollover, and modern devices manufactured after 2010 are largely designed with a 13-bit week counter that only needs to roll over every 157 years. That'll be a lot for that way. Let me drop for a second. Still, some people wear belts and suspenders and live a very cautious life. Trend Micro Vice President Bill Malik offered a word of caution. He said that he wouldn't personally be flying that day, and he perceives other potential safety issues. He says ports load and unload containers automatically using GPS to guide the cranes. Public safety systems incorporate GPS systems, as do traffic monitoring systems for bridges. He says 20 years ago, these links were primitive. Now they are embedded, so any impact now will substantially be greater. If the primary way you interact with the GPS systems comes from your smartphone, you're probably all up to date. If you utilize older GPS systems that don't meet the ISGPS 200 standards, the Department of Homeland Security recommends you manufacture and ask them a few questions. So it probably won't amount to anything, but I would suggest steering clear of cargo ships and airplanes. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2DS.
So the world's going to come to an end 157 years from now? WB2GXM.
No, Rich, some other guy on some other science net will talk about the GPS rollover in 157 years from now. Maybe.
Oh, was that date again in April? Go ahead.
The one that's coming up is April 6th. That's our magic hour. I don't have a date for the time that the 13-bit rollover that happens 157 years in the future.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, very good. On to the next. I don't know if people here follow the news from the annual Consumer Electronics Show. They hold it every January in Las Vegas. But foldable phones kind of arrived in a really big way during that show. And there's been other announcements later in February about the same thing, but there seems to be a fundamental problem in that they don't quite work. The buzzworthy phone introduced at Samsung's Unpacked and organization called MWC are not truly foldable. They're bendable. The good news is that Corning, the company behind Gorilla Glass, very famous stuff, is hurrying to come up with the solution. One glaring issue with the Galaxy Fold is that it doesn't really fold flat. Instead, when it's closed, there's a noticeable gap at the hinge. Now, that's because we don't really have a truly foldable glass. Instead, the Galaxy Fold and Hiwise Madex use something like plastic polymers, which can flex repeatedly, but also is prone to scratching and creases. So, it makes sense that Gorilla Glass, the company that has become synonymous with smartphone glass, is working to close the gap. According to Wired, Corning is in the process of developing an ultra-thin, bendable glass that's 0.1 millimeters thick and can bend to 5 millimeters in radius without sacrificing strength and durability. The catch is that those contradictory aims go against the basic principles of physics. Let me drop for a second. As was said, in a glass solution, you're really challenging the laws of physics in that to get a very tight bend radius, you want to go thinner and thinner, but you also have to be able to survive a drop event and resist damage. This was said by a representative of Corning Gorilla Glass. While Corning hasn't made any official announcements about this work, sources close to the company told Wired magazine that the new glass could be ready in a couple of years, or that competitors like Japan's AGC might have a similar product even sooner. With any luck, the price of foldable smartphones will come down as glass technology rises, and in a few years, we'll have a truly foldable device in our pocket. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is, as always, AC2GS.
Will you be to check some?
Yes, Rich.
Most materials, if they are bent or folded in the same spot over time, will eventually separate at that spot. Are they addressing this problem? WP2GX.
Well, that would be my understanding. Basically, if you have something that operates the same way that metal fatigue that I'm very familiar with, you can take a paperclip and bend it a few times and not have a problem. But if you keep bending it back and forth, you generate local heat. It disrupts the grain pattern in the metal lattice and weakens it progressively until it just kind of falls apart. So it would be rather important. I would think that any company worth a single bit of its stock would not let loose a consumer product with a label saying, caution, you can only open and close this phone 500 times before it will snap in half. But again, that's conjecture.
Reminds me of the earlier question with the TV, as in, why do we need it, WBTGXM?
Well, Rick, in my opinion, the answer to the previous question was because the marketers have impressed us that we must have it. In the same way with this. It looks cool. I mean, if you've seen the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, and the other presentations of foldable phones, it looks cool in that there's always this question, how big should your cell phone be? What's been happening lately is cell phones have been growing bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where they don't fit into a lot of people's pockets. But imagine if you had a cell phone that could be small, but you could unfold it and it could be big. So you have a big phone that fits in your pocket, you have a small phone that fits in your pocket, and a big phone that you don't have to squint at. So there are some positive aspects to it, but a lot of it is just marketing and looking cool. Doggy, somehow I think I'm not going to, if I was a salesman, I wouldn't be selling that many bendable cell phones to our crowd here. Dick, would you be interested in a bending cell phone? I don't think you have a cell phone. I guess Dick has walked away for a moment to do something. I will move on to the next subject. Let's see. Don't look now, but one of our most feared dinosaurs have gotten a whole lot fluffier these days. The latest fossil discoveries in paleontological research continues to revise our view of the world's most famous dinosaur, the famous Tyrannosaurus Rex. An updated depiction of the extinct giant is now on display locally at the American Museum of Natural History. That's bound to ruffle some feathers, if you will. From the opening room of the American Museum of Natural History's display, where a model of a fluffy, bird-like juvenile takes the stage, to the final interactive video wall of a full-motion, earth-shaking dinosaur, the exhibit is peppered with new insights and more than a few nagging mysteries. The centerpiece of Teeth, the Ultimate Predator, is a full-scale, full-color model into which the curators poured all their latest research. Fans of T-Rex will note that the adult dinosaurs, which generally only live to their late 20s, looks more svelte in this incarnation and has slightly raised the rear haunches. Let me drop for a second. The real novel thing is tufts of feathers adore the T-Rex's head and run down its spine. It's widely accepted now that many dinosaurs had feathers and bird-like features. Indeed, paleontologists discovered the first fossilized remains of Tyrannosaurus in China back in 2004. However, putting plumage on adult T-Rexes is still considered by some to be an inferential leap. And researchers have been applying increasingly refined techniques to investigate the fossil records, so often combining several disciplines. For example, paleontobiologists now know that the T-Rex had a literally bone-crushing bite force of nearly 8,000 pounds thanks to a mechanical model of the head and chemical analysis of its fossilized feces. We know some of what T-Rex ate because of its poop. 50% of it was actually bone. Thanks to X-ray fluorescence and microprobe analysis, we know T-Rex chewed up and swallowed the bones of its victim. T-Rex is now thought to have been a head killer. That is, it used its head to kill. From the force of its bite to its regenerating, gigantic, sharp, pointy teeth. And the digested evidence, scientists say, we can infer something about its predatory practice. It probably didn't use its notoriously tiny little forearms for much at all. Let me drop for a second. Now, some paleontologists think that their forearms were just vestigial, just remnants, while the arms with sharp claws could have been used to detect its prey. The evidence suggests it wasn't really necessary. Using CT scanning and 3D modeling, researchers have also concluded that T-Rex was smarter than your average tyrannosaur. It had a larger brain than previously thought, with a more pronounced olfactory area and larger eyes, indicating it had acute senses of smell and sharp vision. Also, along the skull of this giant dinosaur were several pronounced bumps. Some researchers have suggested that the protuberances are an indication of additional armor or horn-like growth, but exhibition teams eschew adding horns to their particular models. It turns out that the nodes on dinosaurs were probably more like those of lizards and crocodiles, which don't have horns. So what about the sound of thunder that T-Rex roar, you know, that you hear in those great movies that everyone watches? Well, the dinosaur's throat structure and surrounding soft cartilage are not the things that got observed in fossil records, according to the paleontologist. Sounds don't fossilize, he said. However, from what they can determine from T-Rex's overall cranial structure, it probably didn't have a Jurassic Park-like roar, but also it didn't chirp like a bird either, thankfully. Best guess is something akin to a crocodile's bellow. So perhaps the biggest mystery that's still surrounding T-Rex and other dinosaurs is what color they may have sported. Was the great predator a bronze Victor Magenta monster? Either way, these are not your grandfather's T-Rexes. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Thanks, Jim.
Repeater, time out.
Thanks, Jim.
Yes, Wesley, what's your question?
Yeah, kind of, you mentioned X-ray fluorescence, and, we take to the EDXRF, actually I have EDXRF in my home. The emission of the secondary fluorescent X-rays from the material that has been excited by bombarding with high energy X-rays. The problem that I have with it is if they use EDXRF or XRF, it only shows the periodic table components. It doesn't show any bonding material, any chemistry apart from that. How could they just define the amount of bonds and energy?
Well, Wesley, my surmise is that it detected a lot of calcium. Calcium is not something that is in high concentration in non-bony organs. There's a little, but not a lot. Whereas osteoclasts and osteoblasts are busy putting all this calcium epoxide material building your bones. So my guess is they analyzed that a very high calcium level and they interpreted it as half of the food comes from bone-like sources rather than internal organs and such.
Here I have another problem. Most of the EXRF operates from sodium to uranium. That doesn't include calcium.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. The article that I read specifically mentioned X-ray fluoroscopy and microprobe analysis in figuring out that the high calcium and bone ingestion. The exact details, unfortunately, I didn't reveal.
Microprobe is not EDXRF, isn't it?
When I mentioned how they knew about the type of food that they ate, it came basically in the article from X-ray fluorescence and microprobe analysis. So, again, I don't know the details because I didn't really investigate pretty. I kind of took them at their word.
See, the gamma spectroscopy allows, it's the same like the XRF, it's only that we use gammas instead of hard X-rays on it. Actually, I don't believe that in EDXRF we deal with hard X-rays. And that actually allows to go to the BC and OF and E and HE, this part of periodic table components. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. Unless someone has any other question at this point, I'll give a little pause if anyone has anything to say. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next topic.
Yeah, I've got a quick question for you, Roy. The second picture that's on your website, I presume what we're looking at is Pluto and Charon, but there's a third object, very small, in that picture, which doesn't seem to be illuminated from the upper right like Pluto and Charon are. So what is that third object? It can't be a star. It wouldn't be that big in diameter. And if it's another satellite of Pluto, it's not being illuminated from the upper right-hand side like the two other larger objects. What about you, Roy? What do you think we're looking at here?
That's a good question, and I read the article, and unfortunately they didn't mention what that was. I do not know. It looks like it certainly isn't in the same space as Charon and the planet. So I wouldn't even hazard a guess if it was. Could it, you know, be a planet? I don't even know exactly, unfortunately, what the direction the New Horizon took it at. So I'm not really good about three-dimensional space of what would be there. So your guess is as good as mine. Maybe Paul can figure this one out.
I'm also going to guess that this is a composite picture. This is not one single snapping of the lens. The chances of having a satellite of Pluto that close is out of the question. So I begin to think this is an overlay of three separate objects. Pluto and Charon are the two objects forced together in the overlay. And maybe that third round object is what the sun looks like from the Pluto distance. That's a guess. Let's see if Paul's got any words on this one. Got a guess on this one, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW, in the group.
I haven't seen the picture that you were speaking about yet, so I'll have to look into it next.
Okay, you got it, Roy.
Unfortunately, one of the little problems that I've mentioned before here is NASA really likes to pretty up pictures. So a lot of the time, we're seeing images in no way related to the actual image that was generated. These things tend to be patched together, improved upon, massaged a little bit. And so, although, yeah, it could be the sun, it doesn't make a great deal of sense in that what's producing the illumination of the planet and Charon if the sun is where it is. But it could be a composition picture. The planet could be in a different location to the sun when they captured that image and stuck it together. So it's possible that it's the sun. I don't know. I'll have to see if I can dig up more information about this one. Okay, on to the next. Particle physicists have expressed their disappointment after the Japanese government recently failed to announce its intention to host the 800 million yen, that comes to about $7.5 billion, to the International Linear Collider. Officials in Japan said that their government was formally expressing an interest in the 12.5-mile-long particle smasher, but had not yet decided whether to actually host the machine. The final go-ahead will only be given if enough international support and funding can be found to construct the machine, and there is a consensus within the Japanese scientific community that the project is worth pursuing. First conceived of over a decade ago, the International Linear Collider was planned to accelerate and smash together electrons with positrons to study the Higgs boson and other particles in precise detail. The International Linear Collider's five-volume technical design report was published back in June 2013, in which it called for an 18.6-mile long linear collider that operated at around 500 gigaelectron volts. The Japanese physics community quickly got behind the project, expressing its desire to host the machine with a site in a place called Tohoku region, about 250 miles north of Tokyo, chosen as a potential location. Let me drop for a second. However, the government has dragged its feet over whether to support the International Linear Collider, and in 2017, physicists came up with a revised plan to make it a little bit more palatable. This involved reducing the International Linear Collider energy to 250 gigaelectron volts, energy aimed to study the 125 gigaelectron volt Higgs boson specifically, and shortening the length of the tunnel to around only 12 and a half miles, with the option of later upgrading the collider to energies around 1 electron volt. However, their plans were hit late last year when an independent committee of the Science Council of Japan issued a report that failed to support the International Linear Collider's construction in Japan. They pointed out that the International Linear Collider did not have enough international backing, stating that the collider's importance beyond research was clear and considered to be limited. Let me drop for a second. Given the European particle physicists are currently updating their future strategy, which is due out May 2020, officials then gave the government a deadline of March to decide on whether to support the International Linear Collider in Japan. Today's announcement, well, this week's announcement, means that the government agrees with the Japanese particle physics community and the International Linear Collider is worth pursuing and that it will enter negotiations with the machine. However, it will only give the International Linear Collider the final go-ahead if those negotiations are successful and if international support, particularly funding, can be found. It's expected that the government could supply at least half of the $7.5 billion, with the other half needing to come from international partners such as the United States, CERN, Europe, and as well as Canada. Another condition laid out by the government is that the International Linear Collider needs to be more widely supported by Japanese scientific community. Now, that means that it will need to necessary procedures to be included in the next roadmap of large science projects put together by the Japanese Ministry of Education, Culture, Sports, Science, and Technology. Government also said that the International Linear Collider must be included in the master plan of large-scale projects, which will not reach a conclusion until October of this year. Let me drop for a second. The physics community doesn't know quite how to take this announcement, whether a Japanese-based International Linear Collider is or if it just wants to scare up some additional outside financial contributors. There is also a competing plan for an apparently European-based compact linear collider, which would offer higher collision energies up to 3 teraelectron volts, which is a lot of power. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, I see relative advantages and disadvantages of a linear accelerator versus a circular accelerator. In the case of a circular accelerator, each time the particle comes by, you can boost it again over and over again, and you can come up with some really big numbers. But you also need superconducting supermagnets in order to keep the particles in that circular path. Linear doesn't need circularizing magnets, it only needs accelerating magnets. But since you only accelerate the particles on one pass, it's much more difficult to come up with the same amount of energy. Is that the way you see it as to the relative advantages of linear versus circular accelerator, H-U-R-A-W?
Well, yes, Dick. There's an inherent degree of simplicity with a linear collider that requires less engineering tricks to be done. Also, there's some new technology that's being developed for linear accelerators where they shape the plasma and get higher efficiencies at shorter distances that don't really apply in, at this point at least, in circular accelerators. So there's differences in both. What's also important is what kind of material they're using to spin up. Some are electron-positron based. Others are proton, anti-proton, or two protons in the opposite directions and such. So, yeah, there's a lot of complicating aspects to it. Linear accelerators have their place, and especially with some of the newer technology that's being considered. But colliders like CERN are very important, and, you know, they discovered Higgs boson. I'm not quite sure the value of perpetually looking around at the Higgs boson. I would have thought that they would focus on higher energy levels where they are still hoping to find supersymmetry particles to kind of prove a lot of their strange little theories about dark matter and such.
Yeah, I think there is a little confusion here. First, 750 gigaelectron volts was not in a circular collider with large hydron collider. So when we talk about CERN, we should go a little bit to the history of it just to see what's there and know what's now. From 2009 to present, we have large hydron collider. The future circular collider is proposed. Now, the 750, let me just... The 750 gigaelectron volt deep photon access was at first in 2015 some kind of revelation, but then it was found out rather in 2016 a statistical fluctuation. So talking about the Japanese, at first I don't know how they're going to build any structure knowing that their tectonic a problem is ever present, and you must for the collider you must not only have a tunnel, but you have to have a quite steady structure because of the alignment. So 750 gigaelectron volt is kind of puzzling to me. Drop high bosons, Higgs bosons were 125 gigaelectron volts were observed, so a little bit more in this area. Also, straight out the situation with a structure of a CERN right now.
Well, as I said before, Wesley, they were downscaling it to about 250 gigaelectron volts. You pretty much only need 160 gigaelectron volts in order to create a Higgs boson. That seems to be the weight, mass, energy equation for Higgs bosons. And again, I'm not quite sure why people kind of want to get stuck with Higgs boson. I mean, it was worth a Nobel Prize, but it's sort of time everyone's been looking a little bit higher up in the energy level, again, to find hopefully supersymmetry particles, which a lot of physicists are kind of hoping beyond hope that they can prove exist, because they have all these wonderful theories that plug into supersymmetry, and if they can't prove that a supersymmetrical particle exists, all their theories are for nothing.
You want me to be heretic? Since 1970, it's a money play. That's my position in it.
I didn't quite understand that. Would you like to state it again, Wesley?
1970 physicists realized that there are very close ties between two or four fundamental forces. the weak force, electromagnetic force, the two forces that can be described with the same theory, and that we're talking about the standard model. And that would be unification that implies to electricity, magnetism. That's what I will keep looking for, light and some types of radioactivity. So, from that point, it's a money play. Of course, the physics goes up. Of course, we have a new discovery. We have W, the Z bosons. We have Z that is 100 times more than a proton. It's not about proving something. It's about getting access to money. But as I say, I'm acting like a heretic.
Wesley, I don't know if I would call you a heretic, because that would suggest that this is a religious order. I don't consider it one, at least. Mentioned the electro-weak force, which is the theory behind the concept that of the four fundamental forces in nature, the weak nuclear force and the electromagnetic force coexisted and were in equilibrium and were simply different ways of looking at the same phenomena. And it's true that they've pretty much hammered down the electro-weak force. But we're stuck with two other forces that we haven't been able to do that with. We can't do the same thing with the strong nuclear force, and God knows, if there's a God, that we can't do that with the gravitational force. So, ultimately, I mean, poor Albert Einstein spent a great many years out there in New Jersey sitting around trying to figure out the grand unified theory where all the four forces of nature are interchangeable at enough a high enough energy level. So there's a heck of a lot of more stuff to know about. I mean, there's a lot of questions a lot of people have. I just mentioned the dark matter. Dark matter drives people crazy. It doesn't quite make any sense. People think it's phlogiston. Other people think it's a supersymmetry particle. And that's sort of important. I mean, is it important in manufacturing next Wednesday? No. But then a lot of things in physics weren't important at the time that they were discovered. It's only after their discovery that you figure out a way to monetize this stuff.
Well, at first I wanted to fight with you just for the sake of fight, but you took all of the weapon out of my hands. I have to give up. I agree with you.
Okay, very good, Wes. I'm glad we could be in agreement. I don't wish to argue with you. I mean, I always wish to discuss things, but not to argue.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now on to the next. Meanwhile, in China, the Chinese Space Agency plans to launch a probe to Mars next year, apparently. Following its recent successful landing on Mars' far side, according to a statement from one of the country's prominent space scientists, the announcement came ahead of meetings of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, essentially a governmental agency representative from across the Chinese political spectrum, as long as you're communist, I guess. Over the past 60 years, they've made a lot of achievements, but there is still a large distance from the world's space powers, they feel. They must speed up their pace, Wu Warren, the chief designer of China's lunar exploration program, said to the China Global Television Network, CC+. China will become the third country that is capable of such a task after the United States and Russia. Next year, we will launch a Mars probe, which will orbit around Mars, land on it, and probe it. Yeah, I hope it is painful. Anyway, China launched its first successful satellite in 1970, well behind the United States and Russia, but has quickly begun to catch up in space capabilities. The first Chinese lunar orbiter, the Chang'e 1, launched in 2007, and most recently the Chang'e 4 lander and rover successfully planted onto the far side of the moon. The Chang'e 5 lunar sample return mission is scheduled to launch late this year. Let me drop for a second. The Chinese mission to Mars would join a host of NASA and European Space Agency missions currently exploring or scheduled to visit the Red Planet. China's space agency is planning a number of other deep space missions before 2030, including one in Jupiter, according to Zheng Yu. This unnamed mission wouldn't be China's first attempt at reaching Mars. In 2011, the China National Space Agency had attempted to send an orbiter called the Yinghe 1 to the Red Planet, but the craft attached to Russia's Phobos Grunt mission failed to leave Earth's orbit and plummeted. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
That Phobos Grunt mission by Russia was launched on a proton rocket, and like you said, it never made it, but that, their goal was to send an orbiter and land it to Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, and going along for the ride was the Chinese rocket, so that's a Chinese spacecraft, so yeah, it wound up going into the ocean, so that's the history on that Phobos Grunt mission. And pretty much after that, Russia has given up trying to do anything with Mars, although they are launching rockets with other people's stuff on board. They plan on launching the European Space Agency rover also for 2020.
Yeah, basically they seem to be turning into a taxi service. But I'm glad the United States is finding a different way of getting up there to the space station. I don't think they're a reputable firm.
I know. Well, we have much better looking rockets. The interiors are way different. Big difference between what we have now and what. What we're riding on, what we're paying $80 million a seat for.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, hopefully private enterprise will out. I'm looking forward to seeing what all these entrepreneurs come up with.
Yeah, they're doing good. Every day it's something different, and there's a lot of them doing it. It's not only, you know, Elon Musk, it's a bunch of them. Okay, I'll let you continue, Roy.
Okay, very good. Well, let me return to an old, hopefully not tired subject. You know, guys, I've been bringing up the problems caused by the lack of proper vaccination. In the past, these were problems that were relatively far away from us, so we could just read about it in the newspapers. But now, apparently, we seem to have a problem in good old New York City. Amid two ongoing measles outbreaks on both sides of the United States, New York City Health Department say an unvaccinated student who was permitted to attend school was linked to 21 other cases of the virus. Dozens of people have been infected since last fall in this city's ongoing outbreak, one of particularly high. The New York Times reported this last Friday that the infected student, who was not yet exhibiting symptoms, attended a class at a local yeshiva school in Brooklyn, despite health advisories that individuals who had not received their MMR vaccine should not be at school. The school, situated in Williamsburg, is one of two of the borough's area's highest hit outbreaks and areas, and 87 confirmed cases have been reported since October. Spokesman Health Department Michael Lanza told NBC News on Friday that the school is now cooperating with officials in order to prevent further exposure. According to health officials, 21 of the nearly 90 cases of measles in Williamsburg area are linked to this yeshiva school. The Times reported that while there have been no known deaths connected to the New York outbreak, some infected individuals have been hospitalized. The current measles outbreak has cemented as the worst the state has seen in decades, when confirmed cases reached nearly 200 earlier this year. Let me drop for a second. Now, according to the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, at least 133 cases of measles have been confirmed in Brooklyn and Queens since October, as of March 5th. The department said that the initial case was a child who had been infected with measles while traveling in Israel, where well over 1,000 cases of measles have been confirmed by its Ministry of Health last fall. The Times said the outbreak has raised concerns about vaccination rates among Orthodox